to Bristol's Churches Trail. This is a guide to some of the city's more notable churches, giving a brief outline of their history and interesting features. In full, the trail takes about 3 hours, but you can stop the recording in between the tracks and take a rest at any one of the many cafes or pubs along the way. The buildings are in different ownerships and thus may or may not be open, but we have tried our best to give some indication of opening hours during the walk. We also indicate where disabled access may be possible. To help you navigate this route, you may like to use one of the city's distinctive walking maps that you can obtain from most public buildings, hotels and the information centres, or download a map from www.visitbristol.co.uk. Part 1. Bristol Cathedral. We start the tour at Bristol Cathedral, standing on College Green, the grassed area in front of the council house, once the site of the Cathedral Close. The cathedral is open to visitors every day. Looking at the building from the outside, we can see three distinct stages of its history. The Gothic central crossing, tower and east end, which made up the Church of St Augustine's Abbey, founded in 1140, the nave and western towers built in the 19th century to finish the church, and finally the Abbey Gatehouse, dating from the earliest Norman phase. Entering by the north door in front of you, we come into the nave, designed and built by G.E. Street. At once the impression is of space, with the architectural style mirroring that of the much older East End. The nave was built to match the hall church perpendicular that is one of the unique features of Bristol Cathedral. All the roofs, including the transepts and aisles, are of the same height. As you walk up the nave, ahead you will see the choir screen, again a Victorian edition, and a copy of a medieval French screen. Once under the lantern, turn left into the north transept, noting the fine roof tracery of the stone vault, and enter the Elder Lady Chapel, built in 1220. Apart from the surviving parts of the Norman Abbey, this is the oldest part of the cathedral. It was originally a separate building, and when the east end of the cathedral was finished, you can see where two arches were cut through to join the buildings. It is a delicate chapel with slim, elegant columns and much fine carving. See if you can find a few monkey heads among the carvings, a motif also found at Wells Cathedral and possibly by the same sculptor. The splendid medieval tomb on the right-hand side is that of a member of the Barclay family, who built nearby Barclay Castle and whose descendants live there to this day. Leave the Elder Lady Chapel and turn left into the chancel aisle. Walk up to the Lady Chapel proper at the furthest end of the East End, noting as you go the unique cross pieces in the vault, echoed in the Victorian nave. The chapel is spacious and colourful, although heavily restored. Some medieval glass pieces have been used in the restored windows. The cathedral is full of surprises, and as you leave the chapel and walk round the other side of the ambulatory, you see the Barclay Chapel through the arch on your left. It is at a lower level than the chancel and is reached through the richly carved sacristy. It is a pleasant, quiet chapel, reserved for private meditation. Coming out of the chapel and back into the aisle, note the high altar and screens, together with the rich and intricate Italian marble floor, all designed by J.L. Pearson at the end of the 19th century. Some medieval stonework has been included in the screens, and the overall effect is very successful. On the left, you will see the choir stalls, mostly medieval, and it is worth taking a few minutes to seek out some of the rich carving. As you proceed into the south transept, you will see the Newton Chapel on your left with its family tombs, At the end of the transept are the night stairs, where the monks would come down from their dormitory for their nighttime devotions. Take the steps in the corner and enter the only remaining walk of the medieval cloister. On your left is the entrance to the chapter house. It is one of the finest surviving examples of a Norman chapter house in Europe. It was where the monks gathered to discuss business, sitting in the alcove seats all round the room. Take a few minutes to look at the fine Romanesque carving. Leave the cloister the same way and proceed down the south aisle of the nave back to the entrance. This is the end of the cathedral tour. Part 2. Walking to St. Mary Redcliffe. Leaving the cathedral the way you entered, turn right and walk to the end of the railings at the east end and turn right into the paved alleyway with the side of the Royal Hotel on your left. Go down the steps at the end until you arrive at the signalled road crossing with the Explore complex in front of you. Cross the road and, keeping Explore to your right, walk into Anchor Square. Bear left and ahead across the square you will see the horns of Perrow's footbridge. Proceed to the footbridge and cross the river. At the end of the bridge, take Farr's Lane opposite and walk to the signalled crossing over Prince Street. Cross this and enter Queen's Square. Walk straight across the south side and leave the square at the opposite end with the hole-in-the-wall pub on your right, and you will see the spire of St. Mary Redcliffe Church ahead and to the right. You are now on the Brunel Mile, which runs from Bristol Harbourside through to Temple Mead Station. Take care as you cross the road and proceed across Redcliffe Bridge on the right-hand pathway. Once over the river, keep walking on the path as it bears to the right round the second roundabout and St. Mary Redcliffe Church comes into view. Cross by the pedestrian crossing and walk round to the steps up to the church. Part 3. St. Mary Redcliffe. St. Mary's is open every day. Disabled access is by the south porch. From the crossing, proceed up the hill, turn left and walk to the gate at the far end of the graveyard, marked for disabled access. Follow the diagonal path and the south door is in front of you. Standing outside this imposing building, one can appreciate why Queen Elizabeth I called it the goodliest, fairest, and most famous parish church in England on her visit to Bristol. You enter by the north porch, which has an interesting seven-pointed archway and was built in the early 14th century. It has an unusual hexagonal shape and is richly carved. The overall effect has been described as Moorish in appearance. Behind it, a 12th century inner porch from the earlier church still stands, and it is not known why this was retained when the church as a whole was rebuilt, but it may have something to do with the niche above the door that carried a statue of the Virgin Mary. She was venerated by sailors, and they would gather in this porch for a blessing before a voyage. Walk through the porch and enter the nave. It was built in the 15th century and is a pure example of the flowering of the Gothic decorated period of architecture. The strong vertical lines, soaring windows and embossed stone vaults give a great impression of space and splendour. The whole building would originally have been painted and had stained glass. Nothing remains of the original decoration, but the later gilding on the bosses and arms of the rich tracery gives some impression of what it must have been like. Note the fine wrought iron screen that separates the west end from the nave, created in 1710 by William Edney. In St. John's Chapel beneath the tower, you can still see the whalebone thought to have been brought back by John Cabot after he returned from his voyage of discovery to the Americas. Much of the stained glass in St. Mary's was destroyed during the Civil War, but some remains and has been recreated in several of the windows, notably in the west window of this chapel. Proceed to the south transept, noting on the way the model of John Cabot's Matthew above the south door. Once at the south transept, you will see the grave of Sir William Penn, who was famous for reforming the British Navy. He was also the father of William Penn, who founded the state of Pennsylvania in America. The church has always had strong links with the merchants of Bristol, and the tomb of William Cannings, a famous merchant and benefactor, can be seen against the south transept wall. Bristol's merchants had very close links with the slave trade, and it is said that the bells of St. Mary's were rung when William Wilberforce's first attempt at a bill to abolish the trade was defeated. Through its links with the merchants, the tradition of Rush Sunday was established in the 15th century. The Lord Mayor and councillors are invited to this day each year to hear a sermon preached by the vicar, and rushes are laid on the church floor. Take the small doorway into the ambulatory, the aisle that leads round the high altar. Behind the altar, you come to the Lady Chapel. This became a school after the Reformation and was only fairly recently restored as a chapel dedicated to the Virgin Mary. It is set aside for private prayer and has fine examples of modern stained glass. Returning to the west end by way of the ambulatory and north transept, note the chaotic pendulum, part of the church's science project, and the font at the west end, which is medieval. Leaving by the north door again, turn to look at the tower. The tower itself is medieval, but the spire came down in the 14th century in a thunderstorm, and the spire you see today is a restoration of 1872 and rises to 292 feet. You may like to look in the churchyard for two curiosities. One is the grave of a church cat, and secondly, you will find sticking out of the ground a tram rail that became embedded in the graveyard after a bombing raid during the Second World War. That is the end of the tour of St. Mary Redcliffe. A fuller guide is available within the church. Part 4. Go down the church steps, proceed to the pedestrian crossing ahead of you, and cross to the other side of Redcliffe Way. Turn right and walk along to Chatterton House, the small building set back from the green. This is the birthplace of the poet Thomas Chatterton, whose father was church warden of St. Mary Redcliffe. From the house, go into St. Thomas's Street, which is adjacent and leads away from the church going north. Then, take the second right into Mitchell Lane. When you come to the junction with Victoria Street, take the signalled crossing to your right and cross the road. Once safely across, turn left, past the Shakespeare pub, and then turn right into Church Lane. Ahead of you is the Temple Church. Part 5. The Temple Church. The church is in the care of English Heritage and is usually locked. However, using the path round the outside of the building, you can see the inside quite well. Dedicated to the Holy Cross, this church takes its current name from the building it replaced, the Round Temple Church that was demolished after the suppression of the Knights Templar in 1307. It was burnt out in the Second World War, but the famous Leaning Tower remains intact. Work was stopped on the tower in 1390 because it had begun to lean. But, convinced that it was safe to proceed, the next stage was built at a slight angle to counteract the lean. It continued to move, however, so the tower was never finished. It is believed that the clay on which the tower was built was too soft. It is perhaps ironic that this was the only part of the church to survive the bombs of the Second World War. Folklore has it that immediately after the church was damaged in the war, engineers who were unfamiliar with the Leaning Tower assumed that the tilt had been caused by the bombs and were preparing to blow it up to make it safe, before being stopped by local people who knew the church's history. Note the three niches in the west wall of the tower. The church had a very wide nave and long chancel, as can be seen from the remains. The arches of the nave aisles survived the Blitz, but were too fragile and had to be taken down. Of the artefacts that survived, the bells and a fine 15th-century candelabrum were moved to the cathedral, and metal screens from the side chapels to the Lord Mayor's chapel. Leave the Temple Church by the three arches near the Tower Yard and carefully cross Temple Street to reach Victoria Street once more. Turning right, walk up Victoria Street, crossing where necessary, until you see St. Thomas Street across the road on your left. Use the signalled crossing to cross Victoria Street and walk a short way down to the Church of St. Thomas. Part 6. St. Thomas's Church. St. Thomas's is in the care of the Church's Conservation Trust and is usually open on a Wednesday. Like the Temple Church, only the tower of the medieval building survives and is from the 15th century. The body of the church was rebuilt in the early 1790s as the medieval structure was in a poor state. The east end, on St. Thomas Street, has the look of the Italian Renaissance and wouldn't look out of place in Rome or Venice, whereas the rest of the nave and aisles are relatively undistinguished on the outside. The tower is set to one side, as it was with the medieval church. The interior is reminiscent of the original Gothic building, with aisles and a clerestory, although the pale plaster with contrasting dark oak fittings has a distinctly Georgian feel. The West Gallery of 1728 used to carry the organ, but this was destroyed in a fire, and some memorial stones have been placed on the wall behind. The nave has a tunnel vault, while the chancel has a more ornate coffered ceiling. The reredos dates from 1716 and carries three paintings by Fritz von Kamptz, while the pulpit, originally three-decker, was cut down to a single tier in the 19th century. Leave St. Thomas's from the St. Thomas Street end and walk towards the centre of the city, rejoining Victoria Street and approaching Bristol Bridge. As you cross over the river, you will see St. Nicholas Church in front of you, originally part of the gate into the old city. There have been four different churches on this site, the present one dating from the 18th century. Part 7. St. Nicholas. This church is owned by the local authority. Limited access is available, and it is worth ringing the bell to see if you can gain access. The interior of the church was again devastated in the war, and little original furnishings remain. It is now used as offices. One notable content, however, is the triptych that Hogarth completed for St. Mary Redcliffe in 1756. Ascension, the sealing of the sepulchre, and the three Marys at the tomb form a massive work that is too big to be housed elsewhere in Bristol's museums. It is Hogarth's only religious painting, and was purchased by the corporation when alterations to St. Mary Redcliffe in the 19th century meant it had to be relocated. The crypt, or lower church, dates from much earlier and is an elegant building of the early 15th century. It contains the tomb of John Whitson, merchant and founder of the Red Maids School in Bristol, still the oldest foundation for girls in the country. Every year, the school holds a memorial service at the tomb in the presence of the Lord Mayor. At the east end of the crypt, hidden from view, is a charnel house that is not accessible. Leaving the church, turn right and go back to High Street, then turn left, carry on up the street until you come to Christ Church with St Ewan's. Part 8. Christ Church. Christ Church is normally open on Wednesday lunchtimes. Again, there was an earlier church on this site in medieval times, which was close to the ancient Bristol High Cross, now in the gardens of the National Trust property of Stourhead in Wiltshire. In common with the renewal of many religious buildings in the 18th century, the present church was built on the site of the old in 1790. It was designed by William Patey, a prominent Bristol architect, also responsible for finishing St Nicholas and carving the delicate wooden panelling in Redland Church. The tower and steeple are elegant and imposing and make a memorable contribution to the Bristol skyline. Pause outside for a few moments and admire the charming classical portico and façade, together with the clock, dating from 1883 and incorporating two quarter jacks from 1728. These strike their bells every 15 minutes. Inside, the church has an impressive spaciousness, brought about by the slim, tall pillars separating the four bays. The chancel screen is made up from the original reredos, an elegant construction with pilasters and a pediment. The ceilings throughout are ornate and coffered. St Ewan's Church was demolished, and the dedication and parishes united in this building. But the 17th century font from that church, originally situated across the road where the old council house now stands, is in the baptistry alcove on the north side. Note the impressive organ gallery erected at the end of the 19th century using some 18th century panels. The organ case is actually older than the church, dating from around 1710. As you leave the church, turn right to proceed down Broad Street, and take the opportunity to note the many fine buildings from different periods that line it on either side. Part 9. St John on the Walls. St John's is in the care of the Church's Conservation Trust. Walking down Broad Street, you will see ahead of you the spire of St John's Church, which incorporates the only remaining medieval city gate. Dedicated to St John the Baptist, it consists of an upper and lower church, the latter only accessible from the outside. Although there was an earlier church on the site, the present structure dates from the late 14th century, with large windows in the upper church in the decorated style. Note the niches just above the gateway that house statues of Brennius and Belinus, supposedly founders of Bristol. If you walk under the central arch, you will see that the original grooves for the portcullis still survive. Entrance to the upper church is up a step to the right of the gate before you go through the arch. On entering, the overall impression is of space, light and simplicity. The tall, clear windows are recessed, and one bay has a high clerestory window on each side. The organ gallery at the west end is 17th century with seven painted panels of apostles. The pulpit is medieval, accessed from the chancel, and note the rare survival of an hourglass used to time the sermons. The font and the altar table are both 17th century. Leave the upper church and proceed through the gateway and turn right. You will see the entrance to the lower church set in the church wall. The low, vaulted interior of the lower church is well lit by the spacious windows. Originally, it would have been separated into nave and chancel. It contains some finely carved tombs, but whose they are is not known. The church is dedicated to the Holy Cross, from the Guild of the Holy Cross, who held their services there. As you leave the lower church and turn right, you will see a water fountain, that is fed from a conduit that comes from Brandon Hill, built to bring water to the nearby Carmelite Friary in medieval times. The conduit was said to be the only source of water for the city during the air raids of 1940. Part 10. The New Room. The New Room is open Monday to Saturday and for worship on Sundays. There is limited disabled access. From the fountain, proceed down Nelson Street to the Broadmead Shopping Centre. When you get there, enter the shopping centre with the mall galleries on your right, go past Marks and Spence's and the Georgian Arcade, and you will come to the entrance to John Wesley's Chapel, the New Room. It is the oldest purpose-built Methodist building in the world and was built in 1739. It was used for meetings and worship, and some 18 conferences were held there during Wesley's lifetime. After Wesley's death, it was sold to the Welsh Calvinists in 1748 and only returned to the Methodist Church in 1909. As you enter the courtyard, you will see the equestrian statue of Wesley, the only one of its kind in the world. Just before you enter the chapel, you will see the stable on the right, much as it would have been in Wesley's day. The chapel has several notable features. The six high Tuscan columns that support the chapel and the rooms above, the double-decker pulpit, the lower part used for readings from Scripture, and the upper part for preaching. Both are accessed by stairs from above. Occasionally, this would be used to escape if a riot ensued, which wasn't uncommon. The central lantern, giving light to the whole building, and a convenient way to avoid window tax. And the clock given by Wesley himself is still there, as is the table at which both John and Charles Wesley celebrated communion. It is worth going up to the preacher's rooms above the church, where you will see Wesley's personal rooms where he stayed when in Bristol. Note also the two lantern windows looking down into the chapel from the rooms above. In the rear garden is the Brook Hitch statue of Wesley. Part 11. St. James's Priory. This church is open Monday to Saturday. From the New Room, leave by the rear garden and turn left into the horse fair, proceeding towards the Broadmead Sale feature at the top of Union Street. Looking across the main road, when you get to the sale structure, you will be able to see St. James's Priory through the trees. Using the three sets of signalled crossings, cross the road and walk up Lower Magdalen Street, to the left of St. James's Park, until you reach the entrance to St. James's Priory next to the White Hart Pub and just before the bus station. The west end of the church in front of you immediately confirms that this is one of the oldest buildings in Bristol. The Norman windows are set in a series of interlacing blind arches, and the small rose window is apparently one of the earliest of its kind in the country. These stem from the building period immediately after the founding of the priory in 1129 by Robert, Earl of Gloucester, who also built Bristol Castle. Inside, the main body of the church is Norman, with five round arches on either side separating the central nave from the two aisles. The south aisle dates from the end of the 17th century, while the north aisle is Victorian, built in a heavier Gothic style. This was apparently done to support the Norman arches that were leaning dangerously. The east wall is also a Victorian restoration. The church was declared redundant by the Church of England in 1984, but the Roman Catholic Little Brothers of Nazareth restored it and reopened it for worship in 1990. The ancient tomb in the south aisle is reputed to be the founder Robert's grave, but the effigy is actually early 13th century. On leaving the church, You will note that the tower, in common with other of the churches on the trail, is not located at the west end, as is normal, but at the east. It is also, unusually, only clad in stone on two sides. Part 12. St. Peter's. This is not open, but you can see in. Retrace your steps back across the road, using the signalled crossings, and proceed down Union Street, walking the full length of the street up the hill to Castle Park and the junction with Wine Street. Across the road, you will see the ruins of St. Peter's. Cross at the signalled crossing and walk over to the west end, where you will get a good view of the interior through the gate. Originally Norman, the church was rebuilt in the decorated and perpendicular styles in the 15th century. The church was threatened with demolition by the parliamentarians during the Civil War because of its proximity to the castle, and was only saved by the imminent arrival of Prince Rupert and the royalist besieging army. Unfortunately, nothing could save it from the Blitz. Retrace your steps, crossing back to the top of Union Street, and turn left, this time proceeding down Wine Street 200 metres to the top of Corn Street. Christchurch is once more on your right, but facing you is the majestic tower of All Saints. Part 13. All Saints. The church is now used by the diocese as an education and resource centre, and if the building is open, visitors are usually free to look around. This tower replaced an original medieval one, and the cupola that crowns it is particularly graceful and a city centre landmark. The tower was completed in 1717, and the cupola reworked in 1807. Cross the road into Corn Street, and you can see the north aisle windows nestling between the tower and an impressive Georgian building, now a coffee house. Thomas Pattie rebuilt this as the House of the Calendars, a religious guild that met at the church, on the northwest corner. On the opposite southwest corner, the parsonage still survives, thus the church appears to be sandwiched between other buildings. Turn first left by the coffee house into an alleyway. The entrance to All Saints is on the left. On entering the nave by the west door, you will note that the first bay has Norman arches, supported by four Norman pillars. This is all that remains of the first known church, dating from 1140. The rest of the nave was rebuilt during the 15th century and has subsequently been heavily restored. The east window is Victorian, as are the attractive sedilia, or priest's seats. The most notable tomb is that of Edward Colston in the South Aisle. He was a prominent city merchant in the 18th century and died in 1721. He was said to have made his fortune partly through the slave trade, but subsequently founded many charitable institutions that still bear his name. The four Colston societies, the Colston, Anchor, Grateful and Dolphin, still raise considerable sums for charity each year, and they annually attend a service in St. Stephen's, coming to All Saints to pay homage at his tomb. Part 14. St. Stephen's. St. Stephen's is open every day. Leave All Saints by the same door, turn right to return to Corn Street, then turn left and walk down Corn Street to St. Stephen's Avenue, on the right further down. Before you is St. Stephen's Church. Entrance is through the cafe, situated on the outside of the church and accessed through the graveyard. Before you enter, however, it is worth looking at the north porch from the outside, a fine 15th century structure that boasts an OG arch, that is, an arch that stretches up beyond its point. The porch also has elegant fan vaulting on the interior. Pause also to admire the lofty tower, rising to 152 feet with an open parapet and four pinnacles. The top has been much restored due to repeated storm damage, but it is still an inspiring sight. Now enter the church by going through the cafe. St. Stephen's, the city church, has long associations with the merchants of the city. There was an earlier church on the site of which nothing survives. The whole edifice was rebuilt in 1470, paid for in part by wealthy parishioners. Inside, the design is elegant, in the perpendicular style, with gilded capitals and roof bosses. There are some impressive tombs. Those of Walter Tiddesley, dated 1385, Edmund Blanket, a cloth merchant who supposedly gave his name to the bed covering of the same name, and Sir George Snigg, dated 1617. Other artefacts here were rescued from St. Nicholas after it was gutted by fire in the war. The lectern, dated 1480, fine 18th century wrought iron gates in the north aisle made by William Edney, and a sword rest of the same period. Leave St. Stephen's and return to Corn Street. Crossing the bottom of Baldwin Street by the signalled crossing, and thereon to the centre area by the fountains. Cross once again by the signalled crossing close to the Hippodrome Theatre, and turn left and walk up the hill towards College Green, where the trail started. Keep going until you reach the Lord Mayor's Chapel on the right. The entrance is on the street. Part 15. The Lord Mayor's Chapel. The chapel is open Wednesday to Sunday. This chapel, dedicated to St. Mark, was originally built in the 13th century as the chapel of the Hospital of the Gaunts. It had extensive land and was said to have fed close on 100 people a day. Nearby Orchard Street is the site of the orchard of the hospital. The east end of the church was subsequently rebuilt in the early 16th century, and the tower dates from the 1480s. In 1541, following the dissolution of the monasteries, the corporation bought the church for £1,000 as a chapel for the French Huguenots. It is still the only pre-Reformation church to be owned by a local authority, and is the only municipal peculiar. While services follow the Anglican rite, the Bishop of Bristol has no jurisdiction here. In the 19th century, when John Wesley was banned from preaching in any church in the city by the then bishop, the mayor and councillors invited him to preach in the chapel. Note the two prominent pews at the front of the church for the Lord and Lady Mayoress. The stained glass is an assortment containing some 15th century German and 16th century French mannerist examples. There are also notable tombs and monuments, including Richard Americk, who sponsored Cabot's voyage in 1497. The South Aisle Chapel was built in 1270, its south window dating from the early 14th century in the pure decorated style, indicated by the ball flower decoration. The Points Chapel was built in 1523 in a late perpendicular style. Visitors may note that the line of the chapel is actually north-south, rather than the usual east-west. The south entrance is traditionally, however, still referred to as the West End. That is the end of the church's trail. We hope that you've enjoyed this walk. You may like to know that other downloadable trails around Bristol are available on www.visitbristol.co.uk. The Bristol Churches Trail was written and produced by the Pod Factory Limited on behalf of Destination Bristol.